Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
If you're thinking that the radio's full of dreck, then it's time to listen to Soundcheck.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Coming up on today's show, our coverage of this week's South by Southwest Music Festival continues with a session from one of this week's featured artists down there in Austin, Texas, Josh Ritter. He'll play songs here in our New York studio from his new record, The Beast in Its Tracks. Plus a snap review of the new Justin Timberlake album. We'll talk with music critic Melissa Mertz from Entertainment Weekly. But we start with a chorus. A good choir can send chills down your spine. In recent years, choirs have really broken out of their traditionally spiritual mold. You've got the Scala and Kalachny Brothers Choir from Belgium. They've become world famous for their covers of pop and rock songs like Radiohead's Creep and Kings of Leon's Use Somebody. But what about when rock and pop artists are the ones leading the choir? What do you think? Are choirs in rock songs heavenly or hellish? It's a question that deserves a
Soundcheck Smackdown.
And joining me here in the studio to duke it out are Ben Greenman, editor at The New Yorker. Ben, welcome back.
Hey, John, thanks.
And Sean Manning, author and freelance music writer. Sean, good to have you here as well.
Thanks, John.
So, Sean, you recently wrote about this for Esquire.com, an article titled The Awesome Return of the Rock Choir Song. So I guess we know which side of the divide you're on.
Pro, very much so.
But had the rock choir ever gone away?
Well, I think it's been used sporadically ever since the Stones with You Can't Always Get What You Want. But I think in the last few years, we've seen sort of a resurgence, not only in the use of specific choirs, but also in the tone of bands themselves being more choral in their arrangements.
All right, so if Sean is on the pro side, Ben, that leaves you on the side of the people who hate the idea of people singing together.
That's right. I hate, well, all three things that you just mentioned, people, singing, and togetherness.
Uh-huh.
And this is the sort of where all three of those meet in one horrible conflagration of annoyance. But well, maybe Sean can defend them, but then I had a little clarification as to the nature of my hatred. But I'll cede first so he can defend them.
All right. So, Sean, give me a new example of. I mean, you mentioned the Stones, which is classic. What about the Yeah Yeah Yeahs?
Well, the Yeah Yeah Yeahs' new song "Sacrilege." It's been getting a lot of talk because it does feature a rock choir, a gospel choir at the end, and it's been getting compared a lot to Like a Virgin, the Madonna song, because of the title of the song and also the choir. But I do think it's more of a trend we've seen in the last few years. The band Girls had an album a couple years ago that had a song on it with a choir. Florence and the Machine did a song for the Snow White soundtrack that had a choir.
Mm-hmm.
Bats for Lashes had a song recently that had a choir in it. So I think it is this progression. Even the Coldplay, last Coldplay album had some.
Paradise.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
So this is Sacrilege. This is from the forthcoming Yeah Yeah Yeahs record, which is due out in April. Take a listen.
It's
that is called Sacrilege. It's the Yeah Yeah Yeahs getting a big assist from a 24-voice gospel choir. The album due out on April 16th will be called Mosquito. And Sean Manning is really kind of in love with that big sound.
Oh, yeah.
Ben Greenman, I know when I'm being played. I know that they're going for that kind of big finish, you know, the orchestration gets bigger and then the choir comes in and you're supposed to feel that rush. But I am feeling that rush. So
right.
What's wrong with that?
It's manipulative. I looked it up, and choir's from the old French choir, I think, which means to annoy me.
Where did you look that up?
I just wrote it down and then I read it again. There are some choirs that I love. The Jeanette Dubois song, the Jeffersons theme, moving on up. The Langley School's music project, which was this Canadian group of kids in the 70s that their music teacher taped singing rock songs.
Right.
The main example.
They did like Neil Young and stuff like that.
Yeah, they did sort of chart hits, and there's a great solo on Desperado by this little girl, which is great. And that sort of fulfilled the legitimate version of it, which is they weren't maybe confident enough to sing along and they needed the support.
Right.
But I think the one example, and Like a Prayer was on my mind too, because that's it goes for certain sort of markers. Like it tries to borrow the spirituality of gospel music. But the example that I'll use, just that I think maybe is the argument ender, is Foreigner's I Want to Know What Love Is. And so I started the song when I listened to it a billion times 25 years ago, like everyone else, wanting to know what love is. By the end, I no longer want to know. And so it may not be Foreigner's fault only. I think a generation of FM radio programmers.
There might also be something in the pitted soul of Ben Greenman at play.
It's possible. I won't dispute that. But it's this illusion that everyone's on board. I guess that's the problem I have with choirs, that all these people also want to know what love is. So maybe you do too.
1984, Foreigner did hit number one with this song, I Want to Know What Love Is, but Ben Greenman ain't buying it. That is Foreigner, I Want to Know What Love Is, 1984 hit, choir and all. Ben Greenman using that as his argument-ending example, he said, of the poor use of a choir in a song. Is it just a bad song? I mean, can I say that?
Sure. I mean, I think it demonstrates a good point, which maybe Sean can defend, which is there's... it can inspire this intolerable level of over-singing on the part of the regular vocalist as they try to out-shout or out-emote the choir. And both Like a Prayer and that song are on YouTube. There's a Celine Dion medley of those two. And I urge everyone to go see it, to go watch this, because the whole place is sopping wet with emotion. After you should put a towel under the computer.
Our Soundcheck Smackdown is on the role of the choir in rock and pop. Is it heavenly or hellish? Soundcheck listeners, what do you think? Thumbs up, thumbs down on the choir in rock songs? You can leave a comment at soundcheck.org. Stu from Brooklyn is on the line with us. Stu, what do you think about the use of choirs in these songs?
I'm definitely saying thumbs up, I guess, is a nice phrase way to say it. I was actually watching Faith No More show last year in Sao Paulo, and they have a song called Just a Man, which on the recording has a choir, and they brought out a kids' choir. I think it might have been a high school. It was their closer song, and it was amazing. And moving, and the crowd was really into it because it was a local choir group, so it brought out an extra an extra element to the song that probably would have been there if they didn't bring it out.
So that's Faith No More in Brazil, Stu. You saw them in São Paulo, you said?
Yeah, I was watching on YouTube.
Oh, okay, okay.
Right.
So a little armchair traveling then. All right.
Yeah, all the time.
So Stu is coming down on Sean's side of the debate. Let's actually go south of the border and Antonio, who's joining us on the line from Mexico City. Hi, Antonio.
Hello, John.
So what do you think? Should we have choirs and rock songs or no?
Oh, yes, I think it's great. I think there's some great choirs and rock and roll songs. I think Public Image Limited, for example, has disappointed. I think Gorillaz, for example, do some great choirs on Demon Days.
On Demon Days, right.
And also Primal Scream. I think that they're also great with really cool choirs, just like the Rolling Stones,
Right. Well, it's funny because Sean, that was the first thing you said was the Rolling Stones. I mean, that seems to be the go-to argument in favor. But Antonio was mentioning some more, Primal Scream,
sure.
Gorillaz, Public Image Limited.
I think that's part of the appeal for me anyway, part of it is that I was raised Catholic, so I love the marriage of the sort of sacred and profane. You know, I like rock and roll, it's so rough and dirty, but then you throw in a choir there and I feel a little bit better about myself that I'm listening to this. But I do think that the dichotomy of those two voices, there's something beautiful that comes of that.
All right, but now let me go back to something our first caller said. Ben, is the ante upped when it's a kids' choir?
Yeah, I was going to say, I think that's probably an exception. I don't know if the ante's up, but I would move that off to the side in a way because probably most people learn to sing. You hear most people who start to sing that way. They sing in school, they sing in church. And obviously, if it's a legitimate return either to the roots of the song, this is going to sound like hair splitting, but whatever. If it's a legitimate return to the roots of the song or the singer, or on the other hand, if it's definitely counter-programming, Sean mentioned sacred and profane, if it's the kind of thing where you're inserting it really for that purpose, then I suppose I could see the appeal, though it's still irritating. but I see that there's a reason.
Well, there's that Red Hot Chili Peppers song where they have the children's choir at the end, and I like pleasure spiked with pain, and music is my aeroplane.
And also Under the Bridge, they use, I think Kiedis' mother's friends served as a choir for that.
Mm-hmm. So. And in Sean's piece, you mentioned the Nick Cave, that he went out and there were kids and he was singing very adult lyrics and made jokes throughout. They were teenagers, the choir that he
I think they were
with?
Grade school kids.
Grade school kids. So he, you know, then if you create more tension with it, that's part of rock and roll. The examples that grate on me to the point where I won't even consider Sean's examples as legitimate are the ones that seem to be, there's this Kid Rock song, Amen, from a couple of years ago, and I had maybe started to soften. And then I heard that song, and all the things came back to me about how it's this cheap uplift trick. It comes in right at the moment in the song where the argument seems to need it. And that just seems a little like a commercial, like you're designing a commercial for feeling something.
Hand in hand with the truth, I say amen, amen. I said amen, amen. I said amen.
Okay, I think we get the idea. That's Kid Rock with Amen. Ben Greenman, editor of The New Yorker, throwing that out there as an example of why there should not be choirs in rock songs. But Sean Manning, freelance music writer and author of books like The Things That Need Doing and Rock and Roll Cage Match, is defending the honor of the choir in the world of rock and pop. All right, let's go back to the phones. Jeremy on the line with us from Manhattan. Jeremy, lots of people loving the sounds of choirs. Where do you stand on it?
I stand with Ben Greenman. I think we are soul brothers, and we should form our own anti-choir choir.
And what would an anti-choir choir sound like?
Maybe us singing together, but in different rooms or something.
Ben is nodding vigorously. So, no, you can't think of any examples of like a rock song where the sound of the choir really does uplift you?
I think the Stones, obviously, that works completely. Yeah. It's a fantastic song and a great use of that sound. I should also mention the Yardbirds did the Gregorian chants on Still I'm Sad, which was kind of a precursor of using a sort of choral thing on a rock song.
What about
that was cool.
What about kids' choirs?
But when you start mentioning, kids' choirs, you know, it really is manipulative. I think there was some movie soundtrack. That might have been Yeah, Yeah, Yeahs, too, where they had a lot of kids' choirs.
Where the Wild Things Are.
Where the Wild Things Are.
Exactly. Oh, so annoying. And, you know, it's just telling you what to feel. And the things like, when you mention Kid Rock and Red Hot, I mean, these are egregious offenders in most ways without the choir, as far as I'm concerned. So then they start adding in the choir, and it's just like trying to hijack this significance rather than making something significant.
All right. Let me try and get another response, Jeremy, to what you're saying. Kevin is on the line with us from Columbus, Ohio. Kevin, kids' choirs especially, getting batted around a little bit here in the last couple of minutes.
Well, they worked very well in the song Another Brick in the Wall by Pink Floyd. That song would not have been the same song without the kids' choir.
Are you in general in favor of choirs in rock songs?
When they work, absolutely.
Sean, he mentions Pink Floyd, Another Brick in the Wall. That's kind of a classic use of a children's choir.
Absolutely. I mean, that song is, obviously it's about children, so that works as well. But there's something so haunting about
that. But does it work for Ben? We'll find out in a moment.
All in all, it's just a another brick in the wall. All in all, you're just a
Floyd, Another Brick in the Wall, Part 2, featuring that children's choir, and our Soundcheck Smackdown, debating the role of choirs in rock songs. Ben Greenman, editor at The New Yorker, his upcoming novel due in May is called The Slippage. He's against the idea. Sean Manning, the author of The Things That Need Doing and Rock and Roll Cage Match and other books, is definitely in favor. Now, Ben, even you said before, you know, with kids' choirs, that if it was kind of playing against type or if there was a reason for it. So what do you make of that Pink Floyd song?
Oh, well, obviously it's a great song, and it would be with or without the choir, but it's also a song that traffics in these issues of mindless conformity and personal identity, and so there's a reason for it thematically. A trickier one for me, though I would never say this is a bad song, but it does some of those same things in a very different way, is Michael Jackson's Man in the Mirror, which is about self-examination. Very deep internal self-examination. And then yet all of a sudden there's, you know, 30 to 60 multi-track people. When you look in the mirror, they're all kind of standing behind you. Now, you could argue that that's about faith, or those are the many voices, or suddenly I think the point of the song is you make that universal. But I always hitched on that moment in the song. It's this beautiful ballad about yourself, and then you look and the room's just lousy with people.
and it comes in on a key change, so it's supposed to be kind of the money note in the song. This is Michael Jackson's Man in the Mirror.
Start with the man in
Michael Jackson, Man in the Mirror, with all those people behind him in the mirror. We're debating the place of the choir in rock songs. Let's see if we can get another quick phone call in. Listeners, if you want to chime in, we want to know. Thumbs up, thumbs down on the choir in rock songs. You can comment on our website, soundcheck.org. Chris in Westchester, how you doing?
Hey, thanks, John. I was just doing my taxes, and I'd much rather chat about music, so thanks for taking my call. So, I love choirs, but of course there's the caveat. You guys have covered it. There's always a caveat. You can't just do something to do something. There's got to be a reason. You know, you need the right musician, the right producer, the great arranger, and then it just takes you on a magical journey. I mean, personally, I don't want to live in a world where the choir version of My Morning Jacket holding on to black metal doesn't exist. Mm. Because that embellishment can just lead to brilliance. Holding on to black metal. And, you know, choirs and rock, it makes it bigger, right? Bigger than life. And isn't a rock star supposed to be bigger than life? And isn't that what they're supposed to remind us? And if I can throw in, I don't know if you guys have covered the Rattle and Hum version of Still Haven't Found What I'm Looking For. But
you too, yeah.
Yeah, even Edge in the film was like, hey, it's a gospel song, and hey, why not add a choir? When they added the choir to the Rattle and Hum version, again, it just took off. It gave an extra meaning. And kudos to the guy that earlier than me stole my Primal Scream. That's just not fair.
Yeah.
If they would have taken me sooner, I could have gotten some. But anyway, kudos to that guy.
All right, Chris, thanks for the call. Ben Greenman, his new novel due in May is called The Slippage. He's editor at The New Yorker. Sean Manning's a freelance music writer for Esquire, The Village Voice, and others. And we've been debating the subject of rock choirs. And here's a classic from The Stones. Thanks, guys, for being with us.
Thanks, John.
Thanks.
I may butcher the Rolling Stones title here. If you can't get to Austin, Texas for this week's South by Southwest Music Festival, you can get what you want on soundcheck.org. Our producer Mike Katzeff is posting updates to our blog, Twitter, and Tumblr throughout the festival. This week we'll be posting exclusive interviews and performances that we're recording there. Up next, an artist who's playing two South by showcases tomorrow night, the singer-songwriter Josh Ritter. Hear a candid conversation about his latest release, which you could call a breakup album, and a live performance next. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. You know the saying, it's better to have loved and lost than never to have loved at all? I actually don't think that's ever helped anyone going through a breakup. But it has led to some great, enduring albums. Breakup records like Bob Dylan's Blood on the Tracks, Richard and Linda Thompson's Shoot Out the Lights. Now, Josh Ritter is adding to that long tradition. I knew that you had been untrue. I didn't know how, but I knew that who you spoke to in your dreams was never how you spoke to me now. I'm aware the nightmares sleep. Josh Ritter's new album is called The Beast in Its Tracks, and it chronicles the end of his marriage to another musician, the singer-songwriter Dawn Landis. He joined us in the studio to talk about the album and the emotions behind it just before heading off to Austin, Texas for this week's South by Southwest Music Festival, where he's playing a couple of showcases tomorrow night. If you're not going to Austin, though, just crack open a Lone Star beer and enjoy this in-studio performance and conversation. Here's Josh Ritter with Josh Kaufman and a song called Certain Light.
My new lover, sweet and kind, the kind of lover that one rarely finds. And I'm happy for the first time in a long time. Came along and opened up a door, and though I know I've been in love before, oh, I feel it so much more than the last time. And she only looks like you in a certain kind of light, when she holds her head just right. It's been winter for a while. The north wind's wail cut like a baby child's. It was hard to think her smile could bring the springtime, but it did, and now it is. The green, green grass has come up green, and it's feeling just the way it did the very first time. And she only looks like you in a certain kind of light, when she holds her head just right. Stretch the rhyme, so let me leave this where I started. I'm just happy for the first time in a long time, in a long time.
That's called A Certain Light, and it's a song from Josh Ritter's new album called The Beast in Its Tracks, but that is a live performance. You heard him singing and playing steel string guitar, Josh Kaufman, some backing vocals, and the nylon string guitar. Josh Ritter, good to have you back on Soundcheck.
Thank you so much for having me.
So the new record, The Beast in Its Tracks, I mean, there is this tradition of the breakup album, and it's very easy to kind of put this in that tradition, since it seems to have been the kind of the spur that got you going.
Absolutely.
But at what point are you, you know, kind of like working through some pretty toxic stuff and just getting it out of your system? And at what point are you then evolving into actually writing songs?
Well, you know, when I was in the teeth of everything, where you know, the marriage had just fallen apart, and I was so angry, and I was really, I was hurt, and I was bitter, and I had a lot of rage, and I had all this stuff. And it wasn't like I wanted to write songs that were gonna have all that in them. It was the only way I felt like I like had the power back that I lost was to write things like that were really pretty mean. And as I wrote them, I started to realize that they were easy to write. They're easy to write, but they weren't good songs. And at all, they didn't make me feel good about myself, and there has to be a humanity in there. It can't be unremitting blackness, because it's not hard to write dark songs. Just as it's not hard to write, you know, Totally happy songs. The stuff that's really hard to write is the stuff that's this mixed emotion. That's what I was going for.
Mm-hmm.
That takes time.
Which, I mean, let's face it, is most of human experience.
Yeah.
You know, you hardly ever have unalloyed joy or
absolutely,
you know, complete blackness. But so at what point, I mean, how far into the process did you begin to think, all right, now we're getting somewhere. Now I'm getting to that place.
Well, I think my first real knowledge that I was working on something that I would like other people to really hear, that I actually genuinely wanted, was I remember in February, I was, you know, walking around and I was going through, you know, at night I would either be writing songs or trying, or I would be going out on the town kind of wandering around and realizing that I always thought, you know, I'd see faces from my past around, and they shared a resemblance, and that was what it was. And the certain light came into my head. I was like, you know, just when you see somebody just for a moment, and you swear you've seen them before, mm-hmm. and everything sort of coalesced around that idea initially.
Now, you've said in the past that, you know, as a singer songwriter, you've kind of wrestled with the whole autobiographical, you mm-hmm. know, writing your life into songs, mm-hmm. that hasn't necessarily been your MO.
No.
So this was a very different thing for you.
It was. It was a really different, you know, like, you know, there's so much out there in the world to write about. That's for what I believe, is that there's just so much, and there's so much to be imagined that can write about. I don't see the act of autobiography as a feat of any kind of imagination, you know.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, like, so I've stayed away from it. Plus, I see that there's so much of it out there, and so much of the time is not my favorite type of music. But I found that when I sort of felt like I was walking along, I was writing my songs on my merry way, and I came to the Grand Canyon, you know, and to turn around and write a song about flowers or something like that would have been like a betrayal of what I really believe I'm supposed to be doing, which is describing like kind of human experience. That's what a writer is supposed mm-hmm. to do, and that's what I had to do. So I mean, I don't give that pass to myself lightly. I didn't like ask to write about this stuff, but I really feel like once they were there, I had to write them down.
We're speaking with Josh Ritter. The result of all this writing, this process, is the record called "The Beast in Its Tracks." Josh is playing at the South by Southwest Festival down in Austin, Texas, on Thursday night, the 14th. Playing for us here in the studio today with Josh Kaufman on guitar. Let me ask you about the title, "The Beast in Its Tracks."
Sure.
What does that refer to?
Initially, I would wake up in the mornings, and I know that this is I'm not telling anybody who's had heartbreak before anything new. You wake up in the morning and you sort of feel like you've been in an accident, and you're feeling for the tips of your fingers and your toes, and you're seeing what works, and you think, I think I'm happy today. I think today might be the day that I'm over this. I think I'm over it. And the season is starting to change. The wind is different. The sun is different. Everything is different. And you get up and you make your way through the day, and you're like, I'm better. I'm totally better. And then, you know, as soon as the sun goes down, you're right back in it, and you have to find something to hold on to. And I really felt like that those times when you're being just stalked by heartbreak, it's just following you, and it lets you go sometimes, and it catches you at others, and those times are really that's what I really wanted to write about. And that's, you know, those times as the record, making of the record, kind of went on, and I was, and my life changed. I met someone incredible, you know, the anger, those periods of anger and heartbreak, are become less and less, and eventually they go away. But these songs that I was working on, these are some of the songs that I wrote just to keep that just ahead of that kind of that kind of like monster that mm-hmm. I thought of, you know. And I know that there's a total corollary there to Blood on the Tracks. It wasn't what initially drew me to the title, but like at the same time, I just sort of thought, well, you know, like he's got his breakup record,
yeah.
I got mine, you know.
That's interesting. I mean, you know, there is this tradition of I mean, I mentioned, you know, Blood on the Tracks, and also the Richard and Linda Thompson record, which is, you know, like one of the most rip your heart out while it's still
it's
beating.
And, yeah.
Shoot out the lights. Did you listen to, you know, did you do any listening to that kind of stuff while you were in this state?
No, you know what the thing that is that I think is amazing and powerful about songs, any songs, whether they're heartbreak or otherwise, is that, you know, we have in our possession, you know, say if you have an iPod, you have like, you know, 15,000 little pills and you don't know what each one does. You know, you take one and you see what it does to the world around you. Mm-hmm. And when I went through this, I realized that so much of the music that I'd listened to and loved was just like, it was like a loaded gun, and I didn't know I'd had this loaded gun with me the whole time. And so sometimes listening to those songs was unbelievably painful. A song like Alexander Leaving or Famous Blue Raincoat by Leonard Cohen, those songs weren't recorded, 10 or 30 or 40 years ago. They were recorded like
right
for
then
me
and there.
In that moment. Yeah. So
whatever Leonard Cohen may have meant all those years ago, to you it meant something in that moment very
exactly. It was a map of my own heart that I didn't know I had, you know.
Yeah. So let's get back to some of the songs then. You want to do Joy to You, Baby next?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay. We're speaking with Josh Ritter, the singer, songwriter, and guitarist. Singer and guitarist Josh Kaufman's here with him in the Soundcheck studio. The new album is called The Beast in Its Tracks, and this song is called Joy to You, Baby.
One, two, three, four.
I go to the party. Throw my hands in the air. I drink what they pour me, the cups of who cares. Go up in the night sky, up in the clouds. Fly over the houses, looking down. Joy to the city, and joy to the streets, and joy to your baby. Wherever you sleep tonight. There's no ghosts in the graveyard. It's not where they live. They float in between them. What is and what if? We cast our own shadows before our own eyes. You don't get them up here though. They don't come up high. Joy to the city, the parking lot lights, to the lion of evening. The rain in its eyes. Joy to the freeway. Joy to the cars. Joy to you, baby. Wherever you are tonight, 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 tonight. Pain and whatever we stumble upon. If I never had met you, you couldn't have gone. But then I wouldn't have met you. We couldn't have been. I guess it all adds up. Joy in the end, joy to the city, the heat wave and all. The lion of evening, the storm in its paw. Joy to the many, joy to the few. Joy to you, baby. Joy to me too. Tonight.
That is called Joy to You, Baby. It is a song from Josh Ritter's latest album, The Beast in Its Tracks, but that not from the record. It's a live performance by Josh Ritter and Josh Kaufman here in the Soundcheck studio playing for us on the program today. Josh is performing on Thursday, the 14th, at the South by Southwest Festival in the Paste Party, and then at Antone's in the evening. Back here in New York on Saturday, May 18th. That's a Saturday night at Terminal 5. And Josh, has your ex heard this album, as far as you know?
I don't know. I don't know, actually. I think, like, I would hope if she did that, she heard that there was, besides the anger, there was, like, lots of forgiveness and goodwill as well.
Yeah. Before we get too far from Joy to You, Baby, the Roaches, you know, Maggie, yeah, and Susie and Terry Roach, they did an album some years ago called Zero Church, which, mm-hmm, was a collection of prayers, but many of them were not religious. Some of them weren't even particularly spiritual. They were like, you know,
yeah,
and it seemed like that Joy to You, Baby, that's kind of a like a prayer, a wish for joy to,
yeah,
you and the city and the evening. And
I feel like that's, you know, like, you know, one of the things you said at the top about the things that people tell you and the things that people say when something like this happens. And what people always said to me was, be good to yourself. And they also said, you know, you got to learn to forgive. And that just bugged me so much. And I thought so much about it because, you know, I'm not a religious person, but I do believe that there is such a thing as forgiveness. However, I think it's really biological. When you get anger and rage inside of you, it's a biological thing, and it takes time to sift out. And in the meantime, in the intermittent time, all you can do is intend to forgive somebody. And intending to forgive is as much as you can do by yourself. And that song was written during a time when I you know, it wasn't all the way there, but I intended it, you know. And that's what I really believe, you know.
Well, all right. Josh Ritter with us on Soundcheck. Since the last time you were on our show, you have also published a novel.
Yes.
Bright's Passage, which is, it's kind of like set in, is that the Downton Abbey era, kind of pre and post World War
I? Yeah, I guess it would be like, it takes place in kind of West Virginia around 1917, 1918.
Right, so it's that period, our side of the Atlantic,
yeah, yeah.
But that period.
Yeah, and it's about a man and his horse trying to escape a wildfire.
And for you, you know, a lot of your songs in the past have dealt with history. This is kind of, I mean, I don't know if you consider this historical fiction, but it certainly is a historical,
sure,
setting. Different process, similar process writing?
It's really remarkable, you know, like a lot of times now on the road, especially, I have time where I'll be in like, you know, I'll be in like an airport or I'll be somewhere where I have like half an hour. And to be able to write prose is like getting a chance to like run across a beach, you know? It's that incredible feeling of like no limits. And that's so important to writing a first draft. I mean, later on it becomes much more like songwriting, which is that everything becomes, you know, you really have to edit. And I really believe that no matter whether it's prose or songwriting, it's like the good writing is about concision and saying exactly what you mean to say in as few shorter words as possible, no matter how large the story. So I think they're really similar, but for that quick jolt, I really enjoy like writing the prose. It's a lot of fun, you know, really fun. It doesn't have to rhyme either, which is like, you know, huge sometimes.
Well, the songs have been compiled on the new record called The Beast in Its Tracks. The novel Bright's Passage came out in 2011. Both from the pen of Josh Ritter, who's been with us on Soundcheck. Josh, great to see you again.
Thank you so much for having me, John. It's great.
This is Soundcheck.
Daddy used to hold you close. Now in the middle of the night, oh, holy evil eye. Oh, that awful evil eye. Someone must really have it in for him. The way they're sticking him with pins. Whoa. I know he's sick, but we can't be sure. Still, from everything I've heard.
By the way, if you liked what you heard, there's another performance by Josh Ritter available on our website, soundcheck.org.
What's expecting. Nothing is spoken or producer. Never got time for no excuses. You gotta go beyond my flow of time foolery.
If you enjoy the performances you hear on the show, why not join me at one of our soundcheck tapings in person? Brooklyn-based rapper Talib Kweli is set to perform in the Green Space on Wednesday, April 24th at 8 p.m., known for his work as a solo artist and as one half of the hip-hop duo Black Star. He'll perform songs from his album Prisoner of Conscience before it comes out this May. Get your tickets to see him live Wednesday, April 24th in the Green Space at soundcheck.org. Up next, an early review of the new album by Justin Timberlake called The 2020 Experience. This is Soundcheck.
I can't wait till I get you on the floor good looking.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. It's been almost 7 years since Justin Timberlake released his hugely successful album, Future Sex Love Sounds. But this week, the pop star decided his fans had waited long enough. A week before the official release of his highly anticipated latest effort, called The 2020 Experience, the album hit iTunes as a free stream. Melissa Mertz is senior writer for Entertainment Weekly. She reviewed it and joins us on the line. Hi, Melissa.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. How is Justin doing?
You know, he's doing okay.
Well, there was a lot of pressure. I mean, 7 years, you know, I think people sort of expect a grand statement. Do they get that with the 2020 experience?
I don't think it's quite a grand statement, but I do think it's an interesting album to think about. And I mean, hey, look, he's been on the acting scene for a long time, trying to prove himself that way. So I think people expect this to be kind of a blockbuster record, and maybe that's not quite a fair expectation here.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, he had such a huge critical and commercial success and has gone seemingly from strength to strength. You know, he's a very likable guy when you see him on screen, on TV, on commercials. So, I mean, he must have been aware of the weight of those expectations. And, you know, whether he chose to play against them or not is sort of an interesting thing to think about when you listen to this record, isn't it?
Absolutely. And one of the things that I'm most interested in about this record is that because he has come from this very movie-focused couple of years, he's kind of playing a movie star on this album itself. Like, he's kind of not done with the movies. So you get a song like Tunnel Vision, where he's talking about a relationship as if he's the director behind the camera and envisions them kind of going off into the sunset together. Mm-hmm. And then you have a song like Spaceship Coop, where he's playing this kind of intergalactic, playboy who's out there to romance all the alien girls, and it kind of feels like a sci-fi movie.
Everybody's looking for the flyest thing to say. Flyest thing to say. But I just want to fly, fly away with you.
That is from the new Justin Timberlake record, The 2020 Experience, out on Tuesday, March 19th, but streaming in its entirety on iTunes right now. And Spaceship Coop, we're speaking with Melissa Mertz, senior writer for Entertainment Weekly. And a lot of the album, Melissa, seems to have this kind of mid-tempo feel to it.
Yeah, it does. And, you know, I think when most people think of Justin Timberlake as he started out as a solo artist, they really think of him as being energetic. You know, they think of him dancing and having these very upbeat songs. And it really is kind of a slow album. And I think that might be a disappointment to some people to not have that kind of old school razzle dazzle that they're used to with Justin Timberlake.
Well, now we've had a chance to hear the first single, Suit and Tie, which features Jay-Z. In a sense, I guess that's not really representative of the rest of the record, because aside from Jay-Z's turn on that song, there don't seem to be a whole lot of guests on the new Timberlake record.
No, and it's mostly just him and Timbaland. I mean, Timbaland is his longtime producer, so he's really kind of that's the real duo at the heart of this record. And I guess the real flash, instead of having a bunch of cameos, is just in the way that it's produced. I mean, there's a lot of very interesting kind of sonic details that Timbaland is known for. Like, you can hear the sound of crickets chirping in one song, and there's another song that kind of has a Bollywood vibe to it. You know, he makes a sample out of someone breathing in a different song. And there's all these cool sonic tricks that I guess kind of take the place of the flash of having, you know, maybe like someone like Kanye West on the record, who, by the way, I guess is not on the greatest terms with Justin Timberlake after Suit and Tie. I think he kind of dissed that song.
But basically, you know, we've had 2 months to live with the song Suit and Tie. What has the critical response to that been?
Well, I think the critical response was a little bit meh. I don't think people were all that excited about it, but surprisingly, the fans really have been. I mean, I think that it got the highest first-week plays on Billboard's Pop Songs chart, which measures mainstream top 40 airplay, so people are requesting it, and it seems like, you know, it's still doing relatively well fan-wise. So I guess, you know, as long as there's demand from the fans, maybe it doesn't matter so much what if we aren't so thrilled by it.
Right. Now, so for you, though, what are the highlights of the 2020 experience?
Well, I really like the moments when he sort of steps it up a little bit energetically. So I love this song called Let the Groove In, which starts with kind of an African rhythm and like hand drum kind of rhythms and a little bit of cowbell, and builds into the type of song you might hear on an old Michael Jackson record.
Are you comfortable right there?
Called Let the Groove In, and you'll find it on the new Justin Timberlake record, The 2020 Experience, out on Tuesday, March 19th, his first in almost 7 years. Melissa Meritz, senior writer for Entertainment Weekly, has reviewed the album and is on the line with us and tells us that Let the Groove In is one of the highlights of the record. Do you wish there was more kind of this dance-oriented, up-tempo stuff on this record?
I do. I mean, it's a relatively slow album. And even with something like Suit and Tie, you know, there's this very long, slow kind of fake-out intro to it. Sometimes I wish he'd just get to the beat.
So what would you say? I mean, I asked you for a highlight. Let the Groove In is that. What for you is sort of the low point of this new Timberlake record?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of songs. Blue Ocean Floor is a very slow song, which I think has its merits, but it's just so slow and ballady that it's a little bit snoozy. But the real thing that bothers me on some of these tracks is a song like Mirrors, which is ostensibly a love song, but it's just so self-involved. I mean, mirrors are obviously a big conceit that have been in pop songs forever. I think of like the Velvet Underground and Diana Ross using it. But here he's really just looking in a mirror and saying, you were reflect me back to me, and that's what I love about you, which is kind of a weird thing to say to a girl.
Especially when you've been recently married. I wonder how Jessica Biel feels about Justin singing to his own reflection in the mirror.
And especially since you've been accused before you got married of being kind of a self-interested boyfriend, too.
Well, let's hear a little bit of the song Mirrors from the new Justin Timberlake record, The 2020 Experience.
It's like you're my mirror. Oh, my mirror staring back at me. Oh, I couldn't get any bigger. Oh, with anyone else beside of me. Oh, and now as clear as this promise that we're making to reflections into one.
Mirrors is the name of the song from Justin Timberlake's The 2020 Experience. And Melissa, whatever reservations you have about the implicit narcissism of this song, at least he sounds involved here. A lot of this record, it seems, it's very cool, almost detached sounding, at least, you know, as I listen to the record.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. It's a very slow record. It's kind of detached. There's a lot of effects going on with his vocals. It doesn't really sound as immediate as something like Sexy Back or mm-hmm. you know, something on his first record, Justified.
But it has been 7 years since Future Sex Love Sounds, almost 7 years. Was it worth the wait?
I think it remains to be seen. I'm not crazy about this record, but I think that there's still enough songs on here to make me think that he has a bit of a career left.
All right. Melissa Maritz, a senior writer for Entertainment Weekly. Melissa, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
This is Soundcheck.
Hey, little mama, I gotta ask me if I want to. Just tell me, can I get a light? Roll you up and let it run through.
That does it for tonight's show. Tomorrow, join us online at 2 p.m. for a live performance by the experimental duo of Buke and Gace. You'll be able to listen in as they record a session for an upcoming edition of Soundcheck. Buke and Gace in a live audio stream, 2 p.m. Eastern on soundcheck.org. Plus, our coverage of South by Southwest continues with the Swedish band Shout Out Louds. They'll talk about the new direction on their latest album, and they'll play songs from it live in our studio. And our contributor Joe Levy on a new collection from Jimi Hendrix. Our theme song was composed by the New York keyboardist Marco Benevento. It's called Eagle Rock, and it appears on his latest album, Tiger Face. You can find out more about Marco and his music by clicking the link called About Our Theme Song at soundcheck.org. See you back here tomorrow night at 9. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.